to everyone. This is the LaRouche Show, November 30th. I'd like to welcome you all for the next hour live on the internet and also with the telephone conference call. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I'm the economics co-editor for Executive Intelligence Review. Now, today we have in the studio for the whole first hour special guest Jeffrey Steinberg. He is the co-editor for Counterintelligence for Executive Intelligence Review. He is the advisor and consultant on many kinds of research for Lyndon LaRouche. I think he had a chance to speak with him before the show today. So we have much to talk about, and I'm going to go to Jeff. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Marcia. How are you?
Good. I'm going to come right to you, Jeff, but first, a few short announcements. I just want to let people know who are listening by telephone on the organizers' conference call that following the internet hour of the LaRouche Show, Jeffrey Steinberg will remain on the phone. Harley Schlanger, who's a representative of the Lyndon LaRouche campaign in 2004, he'll be on the phone. One of our national youth leaders, Quincy O'Neill, will be there, and Bob Baker as well, moderator of the conference call. So just have that in mind. And secondly, again, for those on the telephone organizers conference call, about halfway through our discussion with Jeff Steinberg now, live on the LaRouche Show, Bob Baker, our moderator, will ask you for any questions that you want relayed to Jeff, and we'll do it at that time. All of you listening by internet or any other way, but by internet, you can send in your questions email anytime now during the next 59 minutes. You can see that on your screen, how to do that, and I'll give some phone numbers in case you want to call in when we get into the discussion. Okay, with that, we're going to turn to Jeff Steinberg. We have many specific developments in Thanksgiving week here in the United States, but around the world, and such as the Thursday, that was Thanksgiving Day here in the United States. In Israel, there were the elections for the Likud Party. This occurs amidst, there were bombings in Kenya, people saw that in their news headlines, but in the backdrop to all of this is the ongoing unraveling of the U.S. and the global economy, the threat of those who want to respond by war. Jeff, I'm just going to ask you to start anywhere and put some of these things in perspective, please.
Well, the economic crisis, I think, is really the basis on which to understand why it is that even though we've succeeded, Lyndon LaRouche in particular played a pivotal role in, for the time being, stopping a full-scale war in Iraq that would have been a trigger for a much larger clash of civilizations conflict. We stopped that from happening. That war was supposed to have begun before the November 5th election date in the United States. There was a concerted effort of leading figures associated with the institution of the presidency, LaRouche included, prominent former military officials included, and we did succeed in defeating the efforts of a rather Mad Hatter faction inside the Bush administration. They go by many names. They're referred to as the Chicken Hawks, people like Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, and even Vice President Dick Cheney and Attorney General John Ashcroft. They were all draft resistors or avoided military service, yet these people with admittedly zero experience in military affairs are the leading advocates of this specific war in Iraq and the broader war against the entire Islamic world and China. So why the war danger? Why does it persist? Because the underlying crisis that the U.S. government and, frankly, every government around the planet is facing is the fact that we are already into a depression collapse, already far more severe than the situation that people lived through in the 1929 to late 1930s. Just this past several days, among the leading news headlines are the expectation that perhaps as early as Monday, United Airlines, the second largest air carrier in the United States, perhaps in the world, is going to be faced with filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. What this means is that, in effect, the entire American airline industry is on the verge of total collapse, considering that we've already taken down what once existed as a major nationwide commercial and passenger rail system, we may be faced with a situation very soon where unless you get in a car or truck and drive from coast to coast, there may be no way to get there. And so this kind of crisis was described by Mr. LaRouche in his Thanksgiving Day greetings to the American people and the world population as a case of moral and psychological bankruptcy, even more so than the actual state of bankruptcy of the American economy and the international financial and monetary system. Last week, Congress fled Washington, having left behind a major disaster in the form of 1 million Americans being needlessly kicked off of unemployment benefits 3 months early on the 28th of December, simply because Congress decided not to get their act together and come up with a unified bill to present to President Bush. So 1 million people lose unemployment benefits as their Christmas present this year on or before December 28th. Yesterday, President Bush sent a letter to Congress announcing that federal workers would be not receiving their full increases in payroll and cost of living adjustment benefits in 2003. And Bush invoked the national emergency of September 11th to justify that action against federal workers, which means that relative to real inflation, federal workers are all across the board going to be taking a net decrease in salary. This is just some of the most recent day's headlines, but we are plunging into a deeper and deeper phase of national and global depression. And unless something is done to turn that depression around by a major overhaul in policy by the Bush White House, then 6 months or a year from now, the temptation is going to be there to crank up the Iraq war once again as a kind of weapon of mass distraction to divert people's attention away from their increasing misery in their own existence and their family's future.
And Jeff, let me ask you, I think that some of those people you mentioned, the threat group in Washington, you called the Mad Hatter faction, mm-hmm. those who want war or chicken hawks, they're sort of crazies on parade, right? They're on tour, if you can say something about that. In other words, they're actively going abroad to, right now, very actively, to do cause some trouble.
That's right. You've got Paul Wolfowitz leaving early this week to visit Ankara, Turkey, where he's going to be in discussions with the new Turkish government over commitments for support for the war in Iraq that Wolfowitz is 100% committed to provoking at some time earliest possible date.
Now, and I mentioned when I introduced you that in some people look at the Mideast as the cockpit, even without the issue before it came about again of the Iraq war being foremost, as the cockpit of danger because of the Sharon Israeli Defense Forces moves of the past couple years. Can you describe what we might need to know or not get confused about the Thursday, November 28th elections in the Likud party when it appeared that Mr. Sharon was reelected? Did he have some mandate?
Well, I think to situate Thursday's events, it's essential to go back to September 11th of this year when Lyndon LaRouche gave an international webcast before a live audience in Washington, D.C. And at that time, the war propaganda had reached a feverish pitch with the Wolfowitz, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Pearl cabal in the administration, with the neoconservative and Christian Zionist media, typified by the Washington Times of the Moonies, the Weekly Standard of Rupert Murdoch, demanding war before October. At that time, at that public event, LaRouche said, "We've got three hurdles to overcome to stop the war. First of all, we've got to get the United States, get President Bush off of this unilateral imperial war drive. We've got to get the issue kicked into the UN Security Council. And once in the Security Council, we've got to make sure that Bush is committed to working through the UN. Secondly, we've got to get some kind of Security Council resolution that would be also acceptable to Saddam Hussein." And then he said, thirdly, we've got to deal with the threat that Ariel Sharon and the crazies in Israel will launch a provocation to get the war going, even though we've prevented this Iraq situation from blowing up per se. Well, as I said earlier, there was a move coming from people within the institutions of the United States government, centered around the institution of the presidency. And this move, including major anti-war statements coming out of people like General Anthony Zinni, an advisor to Secretary of State Powell, former head of the Central Command, the area of military theater engagement for both an Iraq war and the ongoing Afghanistan operations. And LaRouche himself intervened massively, targeting Lieberman and McCain in the Senate, putting out 5 to 7 million leaflets, campaign statements all over the country, arguing against the war. We activated a deep-seated anti-war sentiment in the population, and in conjunction with these other institutional forces, filled in the gap when the political parties, both Democrat and Republican, absolutely fled the scene of battle and did nothing to stop the war. So, inside Israel itself, very clearly, certain sane political forces, again, large factions within the Israeli military, recognize the danger, as LaRouche laid it out, of an Israeli breakaway ally provocation to get this war going. And so, a month back, the Labor Party pulled out of the Sharon government and created a kind of interregnum period where there's no functioning Israeli government. You've got the worst universal fascists now in the government, but they're there only as a caretaker regime pending elections on January 28th, and that's weakened the war faction inside Israel. So now, a few weeks back, the Labor Party held their primaries, and General Mitzna, who is a peace activist in the tradition of the late President Yitzhak Rabin and is the mayor of Haifa, was nominated to be the chairman of the Labor Party and their candidate to head the slate. He'd become the prime minister if Labor won the right to put a government together. On Thursday, I think the most significant thing that happened in the Likud party primary is that they absolutely failed to mobilize the base of the Likud party. There's over 300,000 registered members, and halfway through the day, the projections were that there would be no more than a 20% turnout to choose between Sharon and Netanyahu over who would be the chairman of the party and the candidate on January 28th for prime minister. Sharon, in an unprecedented move, got on television midway through the day with his defense minister and with the Air Force chief of staff and called on the Likud party to turn out and vote. There had been a shooting incident at one of the Likud polling places, and basically Sharon said, if you want to stop terrorism, then turn out to vote. So there was a significant indication, in my view, that people are getting tired of the Sharon government. And to my mind, this signals that there is a very real possibility that General Mitzna, if he runs an effective campaign, could stage an upset victory, and we would perhaps again have a government in power in Israel that would be willing to move forward with the peace agreement. Everybody knows that the agreement that was reached at Taba in talks between the Palestinians, the Israelis, the Clinton administration in its last days in office, reached a precise and detailed agreement, very different than that fiasco that occurred in July of 2000 at Camp David. And so the content of an agreement, a just peace agreement with a two-state solution, is there already on paper. What's missing is a sane government in Israel that's prepared to sign on the dotted line. So I'm more hopeful that we have a real shot at actually putting such a government into power in Israel. And LaRouche is going to be doing two things to try to make sure that happens. Number one, we know that there are millions and millions and millions of dollars in Mooney money, in Christian Zionist money, in right-wing Jabotinskyite fascist money coming from the United States into Sharon's election campaign coffers. Under the law, all of this is illegal. But as one Israeli journalist commented to us the other day, it's like saying that bootleg booze was illegal in Chicago. It's illegal, but everybody does it. So we're about to come out with an extraordinary story next week in the EIR, naming the names, identifying the specific bank accounts through which the right wing in Israel is receiving tens of millions of dollars in Mooney money, illegal, probably gun and drug revenues, laundered through the United States, through Falwell and Robertson and these Christian Zionist creeps and others, into the right wing in Israel. We intend to blow that sky high. The other thing that we intend to expose is the fact that from its inception, the Palestinian group Hamas, which is behind many of the suicide bombings and other acts of terrorism that have driven the Israeli population insane and out of desperation into the fat arms of Ariel Sharon, is a product of the Sharon apparatus. Ariel Sharon created Hamas when he was defense minister, overseeing the occupied military territories of the West Bank and Gaza. Sharon was the person, the godfather of the launching of Hamas, and the relationship between Sharon and certain elements within the Hamas leadership exists to this day, so that every time Sharon needs a ready-made terrorist incident to drive the Israeli population insane, to make them crazy desperate, to demand Sharon's type of suicidal government, he gets his terrorist act. We're going to expose that next week in EIR also. So we are doing what we can to give those sane people in Israel a chance to come to the fore.
So, again, back to the kind of intervention you're talking about. Our job outside of Israel and Palestine is that we've had this leaflet circulating. You helped do the research or the editing, and people can find that on the websites. I can give it to them, but called "Is Your Clergyman or Congressman a Mooney Sex Cultist?" This is part of the intervention to expose money flows and alignments that are backing the crazy Sharon option in the Middle East. Do get that on the website that you're watching now, that you're using to hear the LaRouche show. And or you can also look on the LaRouche campaign website. That's www.larouche2004.com. And I'll just say in passing, those who watch television, that might include a few on this call and this show, the cable networks all around the country are carrying heavy footage from some of the televangelists of the type that you were talking about, Falwell, Robertson, Hagee in Texas, Rabbi Eckstein, calling on everyone to send in hundreds of dollars to move Russian Jews or others to Israel. And they have Joe Lieberman, the senator, as one of their featured motivators. So we have a tremendous job to do, and this expose will make a big difference. Do you have any additional angles on the Reverend Moon International operation?
Well, within the next couple of weeks, we're going to be publishing a very in-depth historical profile of the Mooney operation as an outgrowth of the earlier moral rearmament movement, which was part of the Russell Wells world government push. Larry Hecht was on the show about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and he gave a kind of a sneak preview of that forthcoming article. I think the most important thing right now is that we're getting hard indications that one of the main sources of the dirty money that's being conduited through certain American-based charitable organizations into the pockets of Ariel Sharon for his January 28th election campaign is the Moonies. Jerry Falwell, one of the biggest promoters of the Temple Mount agenda in Israel, and who is a phenomenal supporter of Sharon and this whole insane universal fascist right wing in Israel, has been on the payroll of Reverend Moon since 1994, when, in typical Elmer Gantry fashion, he stole all of the money that his supporters had donated to his Liberty University and was about to go bankrupt, and instead made a secret trip to Seoul, South Korea, and got bailed out by Moon, in return for which Falwell has been turned into a stage prop at every Mooney conference to take place since then all over the world. Robertson, same thing. Gary Bauer, same thing. Tim LaHaye, the author of the Left Behind series of Rapture's novels, which is the big propaganda avenue for this Christian Zionist crowd. All of these people on the Mooney payroll. And so a major source of funding for all of these dirty operations, including the radical right wing in Israel, is precisely this flow of Moon money. Now, where does that money come from? You tell me. We're looking at billions, if not tens of billions of dollars in money going into the United States alone on an annual basis. First of all, $100 million a year just simply to bail out the Washington Times, which is the, quote, second daily newspaper in Washington, D.C. Washington Times loses $100 million a year, but continues to publish because offshore money from the Moon operations, from coming from places notorious as major centers of illegal cocaine trafficking, heroin trafficking, and illegal weapon trafficking, where is that money coming from? This is something that the U.S. Congress ought to be investigating rather than pocketing the Mooney money themselves. So, big story. If we break this Moon-Israel connection, this may be a decisive tilt factor in the outcome of the January 28th elections in Israel. And at that point, we will carry that one step further and hold every member of Congress accountable for making sure that this scandal, the biggest dirty money scandal in American history, doesn't get covered up.
Great. And as I said, people can get the text of what's available as a leaflet or these exposés on the websites. I'll mention them in a minute. Now, two more things, Jeff. You can comment or not as you choose. One, the kind of threat to our nation and to the world's nations that's posed by these networks you're just describing is clear. I suppose that's not what Henry Kissinger, who has just been appointed to an intelligence commission to look for threats to the United States, I suppose he isn't going to find that. If you have anything to comment, okay. But secondly, the kind of intervention that Mr. LaRouche has been doing in recent months to expose these war-pushing networks and organized crime networks, I hear it's drawn some ire in Britain. And would you tell us about the London Times criticizing Lyndon LaRouche this month?
Sure. Let me start with that, and then we can backdrop into this issue of Sir Henry Kissinger having just been appointed to head up this, what people are already describing as the new Warren Commission to cover up the events of September 11th, not to get to the bottom of it. We received a copy in the mail the other day of a piece that appeared on November 19th on the editorial page of the Times of London. It was a signed column by one of their columnists named Michael Gove, and it was ostensibly discussing the pending inquest, formal inquest, into the allegations of rape and pillaging in and around the British royal family, which came up recently when the trial of Prince Diana's butler on Paul Burrell, on charges that he stole some of Princess Diana's possessions, was abruptly dropped at the instigation of Queen Elizabeth, who apparently wanted to make sure that certain very, very embarrassing stories that would have come out in the course of the Burrell trial were buried, including allegations about the existence of a tape that Princess Diana had made of her debriefing of an individual who was attacked and raped, homosexually raped, by one of Prince Charles's top aides. So there's a new flurry of disgust emerging in the media and among the British population against the British royal family. recall that there was an overwhelming sense of suspicion among average British citizens after the death of Princess Diana that Prince Philip and others in the royal family and British intelligence had been responsible for the car crash in Paris that killed Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed. So now with this latest round of revelations of disgusting behavior, subhuman behavior, by people in and around the royal court, we've got the London Times, parenthetically, the Rupert Murdoch-owned London Times, coming out with this article, basically saying that the investigation should be dropped. It's all based on false allegations by known liars and cranks and tabloid kooks. But their idea is really that they're worried about the LaRouche factor. Here's the lead couple of paragraphs. Lyndon LaRouche is a homophobic American millionaire and indefatigable conspiracy theorist. Over the years, by deploying his wealth and the formidable energies of his followers across the globe, Mr. LaRouche has tirelessly propagated a series of allegations against the House of Windsor. He believes that the Queen is a major international drug dealer, while the Duke of Edinburgh's devotion to the Worldwide Fund for Nature is a cover for his involvement in the assassination of John F. Kennedy and the Rwandan genocide. Although now in his 80th year, it is to be hoped that Mr. LaRouche can make it across the Atlantic in the coming weeks for Sir Michael Peet's inquiry into the allegations swirling around the royal family surely cannot be considered truly comprehensive until the troubling questions raised by Mr. LaRouche have been thoroughly investigated. So it goes on from there, but obviously what's reflected here is that within the highest levels of the British oligarchy, they are smarting over the exposés that LaRouche has recently put out, by the way, not the least of which is the H.G. Wells, Bertrand Russell world government origins of both the actual intellectual authors of the September 11th attack and the Mooney apparatus, which is the biggest source of sex and money corruption in the United States.
Well, thanks, Jeff. I can see we've hit a nerve, Mr. LaRouche, at the London Times. What I'm going to do is make a few announcements, and then, Jeff, when we resume, we have a caller it's Morris from Mifflinburg, Pennsylvania, who has asked you about Sir Henry Kissinger's appointment, and you can take that up in a minute. You're listening to The LaRouche Show right now, live on Internet every Saturday from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And you can send us an email. It's there on your on the website. For those of you on the phone, you know the website is www.larouchepub.com. That's LaRouche, pub, P-U-B, run together, .com. And also, you can call us throughout the week. You can call now, but you can call throughout the week at any time at this toll-free number inside the United States for information, that is, for literature and so forth. You dial 1-888, that's toll-free, 1-888-347-3258. That's 1-888-347-3258. And now, just before Jeff is going to take up Sir Henry Kissinger, if you want to call us during the next 20-some minutes, direct into the show, in the United States, you dial 1-866-857-4327. That is, call into the LaRouche Show live in the next 20 minutes at 1-866-857-4327. Internationally, that is, in Europe or other parts abroad, you can reach us at this number. You dial the United States area code and then 703. United States country code, then area code 703-443-8419. That's 703-443-8419. So we'll resume now with the LaRouche Show and back to Jeffrey Steinberg, who is the co-editor for Counterintelligence for Executive Intelligence News Review and a collaborator of Lyndon LaRouche. Okay, what's the story with Sir Henry Kissinger's appointment, Jeff?
Well, as I say, it's already being widely discussed around Washington that this is going to be a new Warren Commission cover-up. In fact, I think that was more or less the formulation that was presented earlier today on National Public Radio by commentator Daniel Schorr, who's been an old enemy of Kissinger of sorts back since the Watergate period. Look, remember that the push for this kind of independent commission to investigate the, quote, intelligence failures that led to the attacks of September 11th has been coming from the very outset from two of the biggest enemies within in the United States, and certainly two people who are enemies of those in the Bush administration who try to keep that administration on a course of relative sanity, namely Senators Joe Lieberman and John McCain. Lieberman and McCain were the ones who insisted from day one that they want this commission of inquiry, this sort of witch hunt, around September 11th to come up with some evidence of intelligence failures. Quite frankly, one of the objectives of McCain and Lieberman has been to secure the firing of George Tenet, the director of the CIA, who has become in recent years a kind of a personal enemy of Ariel Sharon because of the evidence that's been gathered by CIA people on the ground in the West Bank and Gaza of horrible war crime atrocities by the Israeli Defense Force. So there's a bigger issue of trying to basically get Tenet out of the way and put somebody in as director of the CIA who's going to be more friendly to the chicken hawks in Washington and to the universal fascist Jabotinskyites in Israel. Now, of course, my reaction to the Kissinger appointment was a kind of mixed emotion. On the other hand, it's obviously scandalous that someone like Kissinger, who openly admitted in a speech at Chatham House in London at the Royal Institute of International Affairs back in May of 1982, that he had been a British agent throughout his entire adult life, throughout his entire political career, should be being invited to oversee an investigation into U.S. government intelligence failures and things like that. On the other hand, Henry is now out there in the public limelight as a big, fat target. Now, many of you who are listening to this show probably recall that earlier this year, the LaRouche in 2004 presidential campaign issued a special report called Zbigniew Brzezinski in September 11th, which gave, I believe, the most comprehensive background profile of all of these Wellesian players who were involved in creating and promoting the Clash of Civilizations idea. That Clash of Civilizations policy was largely dead in the water prior to those attacks of September 11th. And the Iraq War was off the strategic agenda. This whole idea of a permanent war against Islam and China that was put forward by Bernard Lewis and later by Samuel Huntington had been soundly rejected by the U.S. political institutions. All of that changed on September 11th. And LaRouche pointed out that while we may not know precisely who were the dirty intelligence operatives who were involved in the September 11th attack per se, we do know that from the standpoint of the always critical question of who benefited, that it was only those people like Kissinger, like Bernard Lewis, like Brzezinski, like Huntington, like Paul Wolfowitz inside the Pentagon, promoters of this clash of civilization, who benefited from the attacks of September 11th. Now, of course, the other thing that Henry Kissinger is not going to want to talk about in his so-called independent commission investigation is the fact that anybody who knows the history of the 1980s U.S., British, Israeli, and French-sponsored war in Afghanistan against the Soviet Red Army realizes that Osama bin Laden has been a U.S. agent an agent of the Bernard Lewis Huntington faction since the 1980s. And there is not any reason to suspect, even in the most remotest way, that he does not continue to be an advocate of that Clash of Civilization faction. So Osama bin Laden was, is, and will remain to his dying day an agent of this particular American Tory Clash of Civilizations faction in the United States. So the guy's a U.S. agent in that sense. Therefore, in looking at the events of September 11th, you've got to begin by looking at the contamination of the internal U.S. security networks, including those networks that created the so-called Mujahideen apparatus in the 1980s in the first place, under the umbrella of the Bernard Lewis plan back then, what's today called Clash of Civilization. Now, LaRouche has a recommendation, because we know that there is a patriotic faction within the American intelligence establishment. We saw that group go into action when the Democratic and Republican parties defaulted on any leadership responsibility to stop this Iraq war. And so it might be a good idea, whether in some formal sense or whether on a more informal basis, if some of those leading American intelligence patriots in the military, in the other intelligence agencies, ran a kind of a Team B operation, looking over the shoulders of this Kissinger commission and pursuing the leads that are available readily in the Brzezinski 9/11 report put out by the LaRouche in 2004 campaign. Such a Team B effort would probably go a long way towards actually getting to the bottom of what happened on September 11th. And it would be a way of guaranteeing that in this case, the Kissinger-led Warren Commission Take Two cover-up does not stick.
Now, what I'm going to do in the next few seconds is turn to the telephone conference call, where there's also a question. It's been relayed, and it's going to be from Missouri, from a participant out there in the organizer's call named Cyril, so we can take that at this time.
Yeah, so Cyril's call or question is, he wants to know how we can get the truth out about Henry Kissinger, and also I think our listeners would like to know, why did they select Henry Kissinger, and why not someone younger or some different individual?
Thanks a lot, Bob. That's from Cyril in Missouri.
Well, again, if you go to the LaRouche 2004 report, Brzezinski and 9/11, you will find a whole section in that report which deals with a group of people who have been ostensibly senior national security figures in the United States government, spanning the period from 1969 up through the beginning of the Clinton presidency. These were all people who were collectively known as the William Yandel Elliott Kindergarten. Yandel Elliott was a professor at Harvard up through the 1960s. He was a leading figure in the circles of H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell operating inside the United States. And among his Harvard proteges were Henry Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and McGeorge Bundy. Those three men, Bundy, Kissinger, Brzezinski, were the national security advisors to a succession of American presidents spanning a period from 1961 until 1981. During that 20-year period, they basically wreaked havoc with the legitimate national security interests of the United States. And as I say, shortly after he left government service, Kissinger flew off to London to boast in public in a speech that we published the text of in that Brzezinski 9/11 special report, that he had been an agent of the British oligarchy whose commitment was to destroy the legacy of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the anti-colonial, anti-imperial legacy of FDR, from a position inside the U.S. government and the U.S. establishment. Now, We know that the recommendation to appoint Kissinger as the head of this 9/11 independent inquiry came directly from Vice President Dick Cheney, who I've already identified as one of the leading chicken hawk figures inside the Bush administration, pushing this whole war agenda. Cheney, since 1990, when he was Secretary of Defense under Bush Sr., has been promoting, along with Paul Wolfowitz and Louis Libby, the idea of the United States emerging as a new global imperial power in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And Cheney's position is that the United States should adopt a doctrine of preemptive and preventive warfare. Now, remember that there were about a dozen Nazi government officials who were prosecuted and tried and convicted at Nuremberg of pursuing the doctrine of preemptive war. So we've got a vice president of the United States who's promoting that doctrine, and as part of the effort is now putting Kissinger into a position where, in a sense, happily, he's turned Fat Henry into yet one more big fat target for us to go after publicly.
Well, thank you for putting it that way, Jeff. And what I'm going to do now is, we've had a couple questions that came in from the Washington, D.C. area before the show began to put to Jeffrey Steinberg about some of the international motion in a positive direction for mankind, and a particular initiative of Lyndon LaRouche 2 days ago to call for kind of preemptive action to supply food on, as emergency food relief to North Korea. That's one question you can elaborate on, what Lyndon LaRouche is calling for there. But secondly, the question I'd like to combine with that is the fact that tomorrow, on Sunday, December 1st, the president of Russia, Mr. Putin, is going on tour to Beijing and then to India, and you have some motion there in Asia. Can you comment on these two things for us, Jeffrey?
Sure. Look, there are two policies, both associated with the personality of Lyndon LaRouche, that represent the only way out of the mess that the world finds itself in as the result of literally more and more insane policies coming online over the last 30 years. Policies associated with the words globalization, free trade, privatization, post-industrial economy, and all of this nonsense. LaRouche has proposed two things. Number one, that we've got to be prepared to put the entire world economy through bankruptcy reorganization. We've got 6.2 billion people on this planet. We have massive amounts of available natural resources, scientific and technological capabilities. We can get the world back doing business again. We can rebuild the world economy. But the first step must be to simply write off perhaps 90% of the present global debt, which is both unpayable and illegitimate. We need to go back to the policies that had a proven track record of success from 1944 at the outset of Franklin Roosevelt's New Bretton Woods system till about the mid-1960s, when through systematic attack and erosion, that system came unglued and was buried by Richard Nixon and others on August 15, 1971. We've got to go back to the fundamental principles of Roosevelt's Bretton Woods system, learning some of the lessons that we've gotten through since that point. We don't need private central banking, but the basic thrust is global bankruptcy reorganization, back to a system of fixed exchange rates. Here in the United States, the marching orders are re-regulate, end the insanity of 30 years of perhaps hundreds of bills that have passed through an increasingly more and more dumbed down, degenerate, corrupted U.S. Congress. There has to be a single act of declaration of economic emergency coming out of the president, such that we temporarily suspend for the duration of the economic crisis all of the deregulation garbage. But globally, a new Bretton Woods system, starting with a bankruptcy reorganization. Then we go into a series of great infrastructure projects centered around the Eurasian land bridge, but extending into a global land bridge series of major rail, energy, development corridors, water management, great projects that will take 1 to 2 generations to really get fully up and running. But this is both a global mission and a policy which is the only basis for avoiding a plunge into a full-scale dark age of war and genocide. So those are the parameters. LaRouche's proposal for a Eurasian land bridge is getting a substantial amount of support from various governments around the world. And early on, LaRouche emphasized that to make this land bridge work in Eurasia, it has to be built upon a cornerstone of cooperation, scientific and technological cooperation, between Russia, China, and India. Between China and India, you've got the two largest populated countries on the planet. Russia, in its former Soviet-era military-industrial sector, has a kind of technological and scientific driver that can be combined in cooperation with China and India to kickstart real economic development in this entire region. Now, fortunately, in the midst of the drive to stop the Iraq War, in which there were many important contributions made from political factions and governments outside the United States to assist this institution of the presidency factor with LaRouche in the middle of that, that stopped the war so far. The Chinese did a critical thing. They imposed upon the North Koreans back a little over a month ago to fess up to the fact that they had a secret nuclear weapons program ongoing, and that basically both the United States and North Korea had both been cheating on the terms of the 1994 Korean Economic Development Organization solution to the crisis on the Korean Peninsula. So the Chinese got the North Koreans to say, let's stop cheating, let's sit down for a comprehensive agreement on peace on the Korean Peninsula. And the Japanese, the Russians, and the Chinese, and the South Koreans have all done their bit by particularly encouraging the building of the North-South Korean Railroad, which links into Trans-Siberian Rail and rail lines through China, and is an important integral part of the whole Eurasian land bridge policy. Now, what's the danger in North Korea? The danger is that the population in North Korea is starving. There is not adequate agricultural infrastructure in the country to deal with that problem. That can be turned around over a period of years with investment in modernization of agriculture, adequate irrigation methods, and all sorts of things like that. But in the near term, the issue is famine. If the North Korean people are put in a position of mass starvation and mass death, then you have instability in that area and everything is jeopardized. So Lyndon LaRouche issued a statement that was released on Thanksgiving Day, appropriately, saying that the United States, President Bush, should lead an international effort to provide humanitarian famine relief for North Korea. There should be no political strings attached, although obviously if the United States launches this kind of gesture, it does create a more positive framework for proceeding to sit down and talk through a lot of the really thorny issues, the nuclear questions, and other things that need to be solved in the near term. Now, remember that in October 1988, Lyndon LaRouche issued a similar Food for Peace call towards Poland and towards the nations of the Warsaw Pact. This was the point at which the Soviet Union was crumbling. And that precedent is what he's drawing upon now, his credibility from that period.
You know, Jeffrey, here, that was a terrible drought year, one of the worst in the century in North America in 1988, and he commissioned the founding through the Schiller Institute of a Food for Peace organization effort. And in December, he spoke in Chicago and gave an address called Give Us This Day Our Daily Bread, exactly a follow-on to what you're saying about the initiative, the real basis for foreign policy.
Absolutely.
But so you see that this trip by President Putin that's upcoming, and we understand there may be a declaration, a Delhi in New Delhi, between Russia and India, that this is positive motion in the direction you're describing?
Yeah, very much so. President Putin, tomorrow, December 1st, arrives in Beijing for two or three days of meetings with the new Chinese leadership, the new chairman of the Communist Party, Hu Jintao, who he met previously, but this will be their first official state visit. And then right from Beijing, President Putin flies to New Delhi, India, for meetings with Prime Minister Vajpayee there. And there's been also a lot of back and forth between China and India around economic cooperation in a wide range of fields. Of course, Lyndon and Helga LaRouche were in India coming up on just about a year ago. And LaRouche had the opportunity to discuss all of these ideas with some of the leading political and economic circles in India. So LaRouche's idea of a strategic triangle of cooperation between Russia and China and India to take the lead in building this Eurasian land bridge, this is an idea that in recent months has gained significant momentum, not the least because people saw the new national security doctrine coming out of the U.S. government as a major threat to world peace and stability. Now we've also demonstrated, and this is critical, that LaRouche can play a pivotal role in shifting the directionality of the presidency of the United States. We shifted the directionality of the Bush presidency on the issue of Iraq war. Instead of a unilateral imperial Roman Empire war policy, President Bush, through an enormous orchestrated campaign of pressure, turned around, abandoned the chicken hawks, at least for now, and went with the Security Council alternative. And if we can postpone the start of a hot war beyond the end of February 2003, we will have delayed this war perhaps forever, at least for the foreseeable future. So LaRouche's star is rising in Washington. It's obvious to people around the world the central role that LaRouche played within this framework of U.S. institutions to stop the war. We're going to do the same thing on economic policy because Bush has nowhere else to go. There are no other viable alternatives. Congress is a disaster area. As LaRouche commented to me earlier today, I wonder if they could get a sanity quorum on Capitol Hill these days, and the answer is probably not.
Well, that's what I wanted to turn to for the remaining few minutes, because you mentioned Lyndon LaRouche was in India in the last 12 months. Of course, he's traveled to Brazil. He's been so many places. He was just within the last couple of weeks in Milan, Italy, because of the amount of dialogue that's going on and which his input is desired. But back here, back to the United States, before the show started today, we've had a chance to see some of the emails pouring into LaRouche, and they're from, for example, Michigan. They're from other states saying, what is the prospect? What is the status of the state economic breakdown? We see it in our individual states, but nationwide. And what's the likelihood we can do something about it? Deborah Freeman, LaRouche's one of his campaign spokesmen, was on this show, the LaRouche show, last week. It's archived if you want to listen to it. And said, you know, she said 5 weeks to go. We have 4 weeks to go to set the terms of Congress resuming and to be much before that have an organizing campaign for the LaRouche approach. He called it a super Tennessee Valley Authority building approach. What do you want to say in the concluding moments about our prospects and the crisis?
Officially, 46 out of 50 states are bankrupt. That probably means that there are four states where they still believe that they can cook the books enough to give the appearance of not being bankrupt. Or maybe there's just a bumper crop of marijuana in Hawaii this year or something that they're counting in their state revenues. Look, the entire U.S. economy is broke. It's broken beyond repair. We need the new Bretton Woods system. But there are certain immediate measures that a president of the United States can take under conditions of admitting to the fact that we are in a national and international economic emergency. What we need to do is, as I said, have a declaration of suspension of all of the deregulation laws that have plagued the U.S. economy for the last 25 to 30 years. Then what we need to do is create a new federal agency which will emit long-term, low-interest bonds to be earmarked for regional economic development infrastructure projects that can be administered by the states that, however, will have the guarantees of the federal government standing behind it. Because the federal government under our system can go into debt where it's appropriate to actually invest in economic growth and expansion.
So the debt doesn't go anywhere near the bad debts that are unpayable.
No. That debt is going to have to be suspended. We're going to have to work out some kind of long-term debt reorganization, write-off. This money is emitted into the real economy to kickstart these major infrastructure development projects that have been on the books. Every state governor has a wish list. Every regional group of governors has their wish list of genuinely required programs. There are many programs. Marcia and I met recently with a figure at the Agriculture Department who said that there are programs on the books that have been signed into law by the president simply awaiting funding.
I think there's a 20-year backlog of local and regional water projects connected with farmer land improvements.
Absolutely. So there's no shortage of legitimate sources. Furthermore, you've got pension funds, insurance funds, four, five, all of these individual retirement accounts where people have nowhere to invest their money, where it's safe and does not represent a net loss of earnings under the real inflation rate. These federally issued government-guaranteed bonds would be a perfect secured investment for these kinds of pension funds and other institutional and investors to have a safe, effective place to put their money to get the real economy going. And that's where we have to go. There's no alternative.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey Steinberg, who's been our guest on The LaRouche Show. The show is every week from 3 to 4 p.m. live on the Internet. And also the telephone conference call of LaRouche organizers will continue once this show concludes in the next few seconds. I will make a point to those on the Internet and those listening in that there is a mass circulation item called on LaRouche's program to rebuild the economy. It's an emergency intervention 24-page description of what has to be done, suitable to get to every legislature in emergency session now and to tell your congressman what to do. Thank you, and this is Marcia Mary Baker saying goodbye for The LaRouche Show.